This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Odyssey. Your Radio Doctor does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, products, physicians, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on Your Radio Doctor. Always consult your own physician. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, WPHT, HD, WOGL, HD3, Philadelphia. From the Cherry Hill Volvo Studios, where relationships matter. Always live on the free Odyssey app. It's time for the Delaware Valley's first radio doctor.
On call every Saturday afternoon at 5.
This is Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie. Presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
Listen, 7 months or 10 months is an absolutely exceptionally short time frame to produce this vaccine.
Your health determines your life, your longevity, and your happiness. Let your radio doctor lead the way with your medical education. Your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie.
Good afternoon and welcome to Your Radio Doctor. I'm your host, Dr. Marianne Ritchie. We're living at a time when volumes of information are available and accessible, which can lead to people feeling overwhelmed and confused, even anxious. And in a medical setting, effective communication between a physician and a patient is the core function of a medical encounter. The most common breakdowns of communication can occur because the provider gives an explanation that's too brief or too complicated, or a problem can result when the patient doesn't report everything they should or that's pertinent, or the provider doesn't ask enough questions. Joining us today is Dr. Joseph Capella, the Gerard R. Miller Professor Emeritus of Communication at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. He's been recognized with countless awards for his extensive research on textual, visual, and video messaging designed to persuade in health and political topics. The focus is on features that make messages effective and ones that render them ineffective. He's written more than 200 articles, book chapters, and 4 co-authored books. And what caught my attention was his recent article in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, from March of this year, called Delivering Effective Messages in the Patient-Clinician Encounter. Welcome, Joe.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Joe, let's start with this. If a physician or a nurse or some medical provider explains a plan or a therapy too quickly or in language that isn't clear, or if the patient doesn't offer complete history, what are some of the negative results that can occur from that ineffective communication?
Well, one of the things I like to analogize this situation of the patient-clinician interaction to is to a standard, almost any standard kind of communication problem, which is to understand the audience before you try to communicate with them. And understanding the audience can take a lot of forms, sometimes very complex studies of surveys of appropriate audiences who are targeted by a given kind of communication campaign. But in the patient-clinician encounter, there's an audience of one, at least during any encounter. And that audience of one is as complicated as the audience of 1,000, but in different kinds of ways. And so you need to understand that audience of one as best you can in the time that you have. But you've got to start there, it seems to me. You can't start with the communication. You have to start with your audience and what they, you know, what their issues are, what is important to them. What their strengths are and what their weaknesses are, for example, in terms of literacy or, you know, English as a second language or whatever the case may be. And so all that kind of groundwork, while it sounds like it's kind of tedious and less important than getting right down to the medical facts, is actually just as important as getting down to those medical facts, and maybe more important because it gives you a way of of presenting those medical facts that are effective for that particular target individual. So it's like audience. It's an audience analysis, but it's an audience of one, and it's in the interpersonal context and rather than in the survey or some other kind of more complex context.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up so many important features, Joe, because really medicine and a lot of things in life are about the nuances. Each person is different. You can't have one-size-fits-all explanations because maybe somebody has family members with the same condition and you want to appeal to, if they're afraid of having a test, say, but remember what happened to the other members in your family and you can prevent that. And if there's this lack of understanding, it can interfere with the patient following directions, missing screenings or not approaching their therapies properly, confusion, more anxiety. And then the patient might turn to other sources of information, like a friend or internet, and not have it filtered. Tell us about that.
Right. People need information, and they will search out that information, and hopefully they will search out that information in the places where not only are the sources trustworthy to them, but more importantly, have the expertise and knowledge to be able to lead them in the right direction. I mean, one of the terms that we use in persuasive communication broadly is the notion of credibility. And too often, credibility is discussed as if trustworthy sources are inherently good sources. Well, of course, you'd love to be able to only work with trustworthy sources, but some trustworthy sources don't have the expertise or knowledge, and they can mislead you. Maybe intentionally, maybe unintentionally, but they can still mislead you nonetheless. And we have, unfortunately, in modern society, a social media system, a media system broadly, where there's so many options, 24/7 options for information of all kinds and all sorts that can be helpful and useful and also terribly misleading at the same time. And sorting through that is a non-trivial undertaking. The good news I would want to end this little segment here with is that patients, for the most part, trust their doctors. They're doctors. I don't mean doctors in general. I don't mean the health system in general or necessarily in the CDC, but they trust their doctors. If they are fortunate enough to have a doctor who is their doctor, all of the studies that we've seen about trustworthiness puts the personal physician right at the top of the list. And while, all untrusted sources have dropped some over the course of time, given the kind of misinformation that's been around, doctors still at the top of the list. And so you have a special place, you doctors, to provide information and to do so in the most effective way possible under all of the stresses and demands that you have on a daily basis from morning till night. But you're trusted.
Well, I think...
And you have expertise.
Yeah, and I'm always so honored that people do trust me. And so I describe myself as a pretty compulsive person. We chatted the other day, and I want to make sure that when my patient walks away, that he or she really understands. And if I get the idea that they're not, I'll say, next time you come, why don't you bring a friend or family member? Because you can be Einstein, but when you're a patient and you've just been told you have a life-threatening condition, maybe not even so life-threatening, you're already in pain, you're already worried, right? And somebody walking into a procedure, they're hungry, they're cold, seeing a little gown. And sometimes the help of another set of ears is so good. And as you mentioned, let's say somebody has a language barrier. We have access to great interpreters. All we have to do now is call on the phone and we have a three-way conversation in which the interpreter, name the list of languages is infinite. So we've made... good headway there. The other thing I always found in practice, I have a big diagram of the GI tract, which I call I-95. But how many people say, I have a hiatal hernia, that's why I have reflux? They're true and unrelated for the most part. And when I show them what that means, that hiatal means opening. A movie star goes on hiatus in the summer between their, jobs or something. Hiatus means an opening in the diaphragm through which the esophagus passes against the stomach. Herniation, if you think about what a hernia is, it's tissue pushing where it's not supposed to be. So then they walk away saying, okay, I get it. Part of my stomach is pushing up. And then they might not be able to repeat it, but they had a visual. And I think we need to do more of that, yep, because some people are visual learners. Other people are audio learners. Yeah.
Yeah. There have been a very few occasions where I think people have asked me as a patient in advance of how I like to receive information. That's happened a few times. And, you know, I sort of say I can accept information in all kinds of ways. But really, when push comes to shove, I'm a visual person. So while I probably wouldn't have admitted that necessarily, but and say I was primarily a visual person, I am primarily a visual person. And we know that visuals are can be very effective if they're the right kinds of visuals and if they're not overly complicated. And maybe they aren't, a three-dimensional graphs or anything like that. But the kinds of materials that capture attention, and when people leave the environment, they don't have to remember the words that were used to describe what happened. They can have that, especially if it's just a core visual perception. They have that core visual material that they can bring back up into their brains, and it becomes more recallable. And one of the non-technical words we use for that is we say the information is sticky, and it sticks in your brain, and it's able to be retrieved in a straightforward way. You may not be able to reproduce it for somebody else, but you certainly can reproduce it for yourself, and you can feel comfortable, a little more comfortable with that. And asking sometimes, how people prefer to learn can help. But I do think visual materials can, especially the properly chosen ones, can really be an effective tool.
Well, what I liked about your paper in JAMA was that you broke it down into four ways in which a physician, our responsibility is to make sure that the patient understands it. And that's the whole purpose of this radio show. If we break down into practical information and I get tired of the expression debunk myths, but I know after 30 years of talking to patients, the most common misunderstandings they have. So we want to make sure that the patient trusts us. Making sure the information is accurate. Of course, we wouldn't give them inaccurate information, but I love that you emphasize, check that the patient understands. And there's a nice way of saying, not that you're not smart enough, but this is a lot of new information for you and it can be confusing. Tell me what your understanding is of what we just discussed. Yeah. And I think that's a great way to open the door, yeah?
Yeah, I think it's a start. And you do have, of course, people who are shy, or for whom language in that kind of context, especially when there's a big status difference between you and the doctor, find it difficult to put their thoughts into words and so on. At least encouraging people to do so and ask if they have any questions. And if they don't, here's another way to think about this anyway. Just to make sure that you keep the process of exchange and clarification and validation of the information in the minds of your patient. And just to go back to something you said early on that I think is also very sensible. There are going to be times when, depending upon the patient's age, language capacity and the difficulty of the particular encounter, maybe because it's an anxiety-producing one, brings a partner who can, help take notes, who can help ask questions, or who can put the patient at ease. And I think there are clearly those kinds of contexts, and it makes a great deal of sense to do that. I mean, a lot of us have partners at home and so on who help us, digging out medical information when maybe we want to avoid it, or we're just reluctant to do so, or we don't have the capacity online and so on. And so bringing that person into the medical encounter with the doctor's permission makes a lot of sense.
Well, I think in our final few seconds here, the other thing that you really emphasize, and I love, don't just hand the person a written summary. I almost think we use more paper now than we did before electronic records, because here's what happened to your visit and reams of paper. Go over that written summary with the patient before they leave. And say, because a lot of times, and I'm not just about colonoscopy, but one of the things I notice, we give people several pages of how to prepare. And if they don't read it till the day before and they're behind the eight ball before they start, you should have changed your diet 3 days ago, whatever the nuance is. You as the provider or the nurse practitioner, whoever is giving those final, please read these directions a week before. Let's review them before you leave today. Let's take a little.
It makes a lot of sense. Redundancy is, you can't beat redundancy in any communication system.
Absolutely.
And it's inefficient in some senses. In the short run, it is definitely efficient in the long run. And any good communication system, as we know from the design of electronic communication systems from day one, redundancy helps and redundancy matters.
Well said. Let's take a little break. And when we come back, more with Dr. Joe Capella from the University of Pennsylvania.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, exclusively presented by Independence Blue Cross. If you have a question for the medical mailbag, just send a note to doctor@yourradiodoctor.net.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
And welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Capella, the Gerard R. Miller Professor Emeritus of Communication from the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. Say that fast three times. Joe, we were learning so much from your recent paper at JAMA that talks about effective communication between a medical provider and a patient. So we know as trained professionals that we have to make sure that we nuance our explanation. There are certain bullets we have to get out, whether it's about a medication or being prepared for a CAT scan or whatever we're asking the patient to do. And we want to make sure they understand. But as in any two people relationship, there is responsibility on the patient's part as well. How can a patient improve his or her interaction? We talked about bringing a partner because the patient could be nervous or maybe have hearing deficit, depending on their situation, right? How can a patient improve his or her interaction?
Well, I think for all of us, I think the key word is preparation.
Yeah.
And having some kind of preparation. First of all, recognizing yourself and the clinician recognizing as well that these kinds of encounters can be anxiety provoking for lots of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Some related to the medical situation itself, some related to personal dispositions and personal, shyness and so on in these contexts, status differences and the like. And the way that you get around, public speaking anxiety from the get-go, which we know is like the number one fear among Americans, is practice. Practice, 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 as they say. Not so much that you're going to practice interacting with your clinician, but that you're going to be prepared to talk about issues that are important to you. And so some of that preparation, makes a lot of sense. I'm a little reluctant to put too much responsibility on the patient here because I think that, patients are dealing with situations that can be overwhelming for them. But nevertheless, they are going to be helped by preparing the kinds of questions that they need to have answered in advance. And to, advocate for themselves and to be persistent but respectful with regard with their physician, their clinician partner here. And so I think those kinds of orientations can help make the entire interaction go forward in a much more profitable, much more effective way. And again, as we said before, for some people that means bringing an advocate with you into the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody has that option, but it can help. Alternative is practice, practice, practice. Prepare yourself for it.
Well, I think what I want our listeners to hear today too is when the internet first became available, people were falling into the traps that if they saw something in print with a logo, even if it were made up,
it had validity. It's the great fooler. It's more valid than a piece of paper with handwritten instruction. Wouldn't you say people fall into that? And I remember, so when we give people written instructions, if it looks routine, they often toss it. Whereas if at the end of a procedure, I say, you know, there's the written instructions. If you have a fever tonight or if you have pain, call us, that kind of thing. And at the bottom, I'd say, your exam showed 3 polyps. I will call you. They read that because it's personalized. We've gone from handwritten to electronic, people putting their faith in that, and then people realizing or conditioned to think, they say that to everybody. So what I'm thinking is, and even now, you'll get an email or a text from a doctor first visit, please answer these questions before you arrive. Again, if they're boxes to check, are they really going to think about it? Because the doctor then should sit down, not the, you know, secretary or medical assistant. The doctor should say, now, you had surgery or, you know, your family history, no colon cancer? Nope. How about colon polyps? How about anybody have early deaths? Did anybody in your family? Yeah, I had somebody, but he, you know, fell off a cliff. That could signify heart disease with a person's heart stopping. Do you know what I mean, Joe? That there are layers of information that we have to dig for. And I'm afraid that electronic records that have their benefits also are making a lot of people behave robotically.
Yeah.
Well, and they're just chick, chick, chick.
I mean, the other side of the electronic records, of course, means is that, you yourself have a record that you can check back on to clarify, you know, well, when was it that I had that first surgery on, you know, on my left temp, or I had that hernia that needed to be repaired. When the heck was that? Was that 8 years ago or was that 9? So having, an established record other than the set of little pieces of paper that you've put in the folder in your file box,
right.
Can be helpful. Again, not everybody has that kind of access. And systems like the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania does have such a system. And I certainly have taken advantage of it, providing the kind of summary information that I can easily pull up and my physician can easily pull up and use.
But I want to interrupt you for 1 second because you made a really important point earlier. Persist.
Yes.
If the glove don't fit, you have to ask the questions, because a lot of times, and that's what I'm talking about, people behaving robotically. I'm not trying to discredit healthcare workers, but we're at a time where the pressure to see more, do more, and you have to, as a patient, even if you don't have access, if you're sitting there and they say, oh, well, you know, this or that in your history, you have to make sure it's correct. I was sitting with a family member in an office visit, and I'm going to make up a name. You know, Mary, her name is Mary, middle initial K, Jones. And in one place, they list her name as Mary K. Jones. In another place, Mary T. Jones on the same record. And you have to make sure that gets changed, because you don't want somebody else's CAT scan saying, oh, you've had a stroke, when your CAT scan is normal. And so I guess the other thing people, listeners, should know is if you're seeing a new doctor and you've had X-rays or CAT scans, bring a disc with the actual images or pictures of the CAT scan, not a written report, because we might interpret it differently. I don't know, just little things like that I think make a big difference, because, and as you say, social media outlets, they can provide great information, but misinformation. So we don't want people to be Dr. Google for themselves, but use the internet to help yourself ask the right questions. Might that be a good way to frame it?
Absolutely. In other words, you can, in fact, use information that you get from other people and from, you know, other credible sources to help you form the kinds of questions that you might have. And to pursue them and be persistent about the pursuit of that information without being disrespectful to person that you're interacting with by implying in some sense that they don't know what they're talking about. So I think, you know, the availability of information is crucial. We need to all take advantage of that. But at the same time, we're going to have to do a lot more winnowing and sifting. And unfortunately, that falls on both groups of people. That falls on the patients, and it also falls on the clinician, you know, the physician in the particular environment. They have to do winnowing and sifting for the patient to help them understand where the right information and the right directions are, and to pursue those right directions in a way that will help them in the long run.
And even medications. I'm a big proponent of saying, exactly what are you taking right now? And if you're not sure, either write it down or just make it easy. Get a big bag and put your medicines in the bag, and we'll review them together and type them in to make sure that they're entered properly, because mistakes can happen. And then that influences what we plan for the patient. And over-the-counter meds can change so many things in your situation. So AI, Joe, very briefly, that's another black hole, in a sense that it sounds like we'll make things more efficient, but I don't want it to take away from the clinician or the patient in their role with critical thinking. I can see 10 people in the ER with belly pain, and each one has a different, and I have to go in and put my hands on them.
Yeah, well, I think the kinds of efficiencies that can be provided by AI are the kinds of efficiencies that we haven't even yet seen. And so I think this is going to be an inevitability because of the attempt to, curtail the amount of time and effort and energy that doctors have to put into routine kinds of activities. The only thing I think I can say fairly about AI is that I am hopeful that we will be as careful in the validation of the use of AI kinds of techniques as we are with the introduction of new drugs into the environment. I'm not saying you necessarily are going to have the magnitude of clinical studies that we have with new drugs, but we do have to have some validation that if this particular procedure is going to be used, even if it's a procedure that, for example, helps to tailor information to the individual, which is a delight, a wonderful kind of advantage that the interaction between physician and patient produces, the tailoring of the information and the treatment procedures to that individual. Well, that's going to, that's certainly on the radar screen with AI kinds of interventions as well. But I just want to stay on the skeptical side of this until there's a kind of a solid validation for the procedures that are used, and that, that any problems that might arise are kept to an absolute minimum, in the same way that we would do with a clinical intervention that is drug-related, and we do the same kinds of drug testing using clinical trials.
Well, that's a very healthy approach. So let's talk about the pandemic. We have a couple minutes. What did we learn from the pandemic in general about sharing information? I have my own experience with that because I was in the throes of it. But what would you say is the general message about that?
Well, I'd be reluctant to just put a single general message on the pandemic, but I think the most problematic issue that we have had from the pandemic and the hurricane of information that was afloat and afoot was that informational environment continuing today in other ways has, I think, unfortunately, undermined the value that people have put into scientific facts and scientific information and medical facts and medical information. And so we've moved from truth and facts to what some people call truthiness, that it's nothing that's true anymore. There's just, well, it's maybe sort of true, but there are so many voices that contradict what transpires and what is transpiring that people's trust and in the credibility of science and medicine has been undermined in significant ways. And how we get from where we have come to where I think we need to be, which is having a healthy skepticism rather than an uncontrolled cynicism about science and scientific undertakings, is really, the, to me, the biggest problem that has arisen because of the pandemic and because of the way in which information proliferates of all sorts, false and true, has proliferated through social media world. Yeah.
Because it's instant. It's instantly disseminated, whether it's true or not. So by the time, I remember being a little girl in church, and the priest gave a sermon that said, slander. Well, we're little kids. We don't know what that means. And he said, it's when you say bad things about people, even if they're true, if they're meant to be private, you have just taken a pillow out in the wind, you cut it open, all the feathers go out, and you can never recollect them. And so I think that I was in training in New York City at Sloan Kettering when HIV didn't have a name. But we were seeing this pattern of these beautiful, healthy young people just melting away in front of our eyes from infections. And as GI docs, we were seeing GI infections. And it was heartbreaking. And it was finally the head of dermatology who said, they're getting this unusual skin cancer. It was almost like the scarlet letters, this big red skin cancer called Kaposi sarcoma. The point being, he was the first one who sat down and said, what is the common thread here? They're young men. A lot of them are young men who have multiple partners. And that then it was called GRID, gay-related infectious diseases, until the virus was isolated. But the point is, I really felt like that shared information, we were working together and asking each other's questions. And I didn't see that with COVID. It was almost like, so this one or that one wanted to be the first one to timestamp it on social media. I figured it out, or do it this way or that way. And there was, instead of working together, the social media, or that access, as we, you know, describe it in any way, was working against us. And I guess if everybody in the room were thinking the same thing, then we're not thinking. You know, somebody has to ask the questions. And I guess the key to effective communication, if you would agree, is a combination of transparency and diversity of opinion. We talk about diversity, but diversity of opinion is important too. Yeah.
Oh, yes, diversity of opinion is important, but it is so diverse now. And the amount of time you have to put into trying to ascertain what constitutes the most credible sources of information, because diversity literally means that there are, you know, that there are an infinite number of takes on the same issue, and they aren't all equal. They aren't all equally credible by any stretch of the imagination. And that's where the difficulty has arisen. We don't have those touchstones as much as we used to. I used to strongly advocate in my undergraduate course on persuasion that people emphasize and take advantage of looking at multiple points of view in trying to ascertain the best way to approach a particular problem in their campaign messaging. I've steered away from that now because there's so much, while diversity in point of view makes sense and it makes common sense, and we all want to test our ideas against the available alternatives. At the same time, there are so many available alternatives, and some are so detached from reality that, again, you don't have a healthy skepticism anymore that's informed by that diversity. Instead, your cynicism about the whole possibility of truth is, I think, undermined in many ways. And that's the purpose of some of the intentional attempts to disinform the public at large. And I think that's exactly what is going on. And that's for political reasons or for other reasons that we don't need to get into.
Confusion leads to chaos, leads to anxiety, leads to anger. And thank goodness we have people like you helping us organize our thinking. Let's take a little break to hear about this week's World Champion. And when we come back, more from Dr. Joe Capella. For your real champion, I call this segment Diapers for Darlings. Spring is here, that wonderful time of year when we feel renewed. The days grow longer, the air is warmer. A time of year when we celebrate new beginnings, with flowers blooming and trees turning green with new growth. That's why the symbols include baby chicks and baby bunnies. All signs of new life, renewal, and hope for a fresh start. A time when we plant our own personal seeds by setting new goals and aiming to follow our dreams, because the cold and dreary winter is now behind us. So when a woman learns that she's going to be a mother, it should be a joyous time. There's no greater gift than welcoming a precious new baby into the world and looking forward to embracing an innocent new life and showering that little angel with love. But for some women, the news makes them feel frightened and alone because they're impoverished, or maybe they can't afford to leave the job that supports the family they already have. This is where we can help. For many of us, buying a bag of disposable diapers doesn't cause a big strain on our budget, but for a disadvantaged mother who uses several bags of diapers a month, it can be quite a struggle. So, Your Radio Doctor is sponsoring an event called Diapers for Darlings. We're inviting listeners to support needy mothers so they don't have to make a choice between buying diapers and buying food. Diapers are the one commodity that can be costly. All babies need them, and they don't have an expiration date. It's easy to help. Visit the website www.yougivegoods.com. Scroll down to find an event, then in the search bar, type Diapers for Darlings. Then click on a gift. Buy a bag of diapers or baby wipes. It's that simple. This streamlined process takes your donations and sends all diapers and supplies to Catholic Social Services at 17th Street between Race and Vine in Philadelphia. Now be assured that the diapers are distributed to mothers and families of all faiths. What these moms have in common is the need for our help. We'll be collecting diapers all during May and April, so take a minute to share a few dollars that will make a big difference. Help a needy mother comfort, nurture, and love her new little darling, because every life is precious and every day is a gift. Join our campaign to celebrate new life. Here's the information again, and we'll also post it on our social media sites and our website, yourradiodoctor.net. To donate, visit yougivegoods.com, scroll down to find an event, then in the search bar, type Diapers for Darlings. You'll be so glad you did. We salute all of you who help needy mothers. You're real champions.
Today's edition of Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross, can be enjoyed anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. Just download the Odyssey app and search Your Radio Doctor. It's health education on demand.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, now Saturday afternoons at 5, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC.
And welcome back to Your Radio Doctor. Our guest today is Dr. Joseph Capella from the Annenberg School of Communication from the University of Pennsylvania. Joe, we've talked so much about the value of clear and appropriate information between medical providers and patients, but then just good information in general and how we should look at the volumes of information. What's the colander? What do you put in? What falls through, I guess, is not true. What stays is true. But one of the things we were just chatting about was the pandemic. Were there lessons to be learned from that? And one of the lessons I learned, for what it's worth, as a clinician, I know I can be called to the emergency room and there can be 10 patients with belly pain. And one of the things I count on is what we learned in medical school, the Hippocratic facies. It's right here. One person might say, yeah, in the last 24 hours, I've noticed this come and go pain. Somebody else is grimacing and you know that they might need surgery within the next hour. And so telehealth, which did spring from the pandemic, very clever and wonderful, but it's plus minus. And I don't want listeners to think that's the be all end all. At least your first visit should be in the office with the doctor. Case in point, one morning, during the pandemic, I saw three women under age 30. Each was called up and said, I have acid reflux. The first one I examined, got to examine her, hands on, discomfort in right upper belly. She had a 6-centimeter kidney tumor. She was 27. The next patient, a young woman who happened to be studying medicine, examined her. She had an enlarged liver. And I said, anybody else in your family? I had asked her. She said, yeah, my dad had liver cancer and this and that. And I said, you know, if we address this now, we could prevent you from having that. And then the third one had reflux. But had I done them all via telehealth, I may have started everybody on a low dose of anti-reflux meds. So I want patients, as you've said so eloquently, to weigh the pluses and minuses of how we communicate and know that the more prepared you are before you go to a visit, the more helpful it will be for your own health care.
So in the early part of my career, one of the areas that I did research in for about 15 years was an area called nonverbal communication. And in the area of nonverbal, you know, what you're talking about is the functions, for example, of something like touch, and how important it is in a wide variety of circumstances. And one study sticks in my mind that your comments reminded me of was a study done in the hospital where the nurses in one condition were invited to spend time just doing just a simple kind of hands-on touch for patients who were bedridden, just anything intimate in any way, but just, you know, touching their arms, touching their hands and stuff like that. And another group in which they were asked not to do that within the confines of, you know, what was medically necessary. And the results were really very positive. You know, the role of human touch and the availability of having all senses active in the face-to-face context can't be beaten by the virtual world in any way, shape, or form. One of the things we learned about teaching is that virtual teaching can't hold a candle to face-to-face teaching. You know, it's better than no teaching, of course, and it's better than just a person sitting there on their own with a book, the virtual teaching is. But those of us who, you know, made our livings in the classroom, all to a person basically said, we need to get back into the face-to-face context and carry out our teaching with people who are near us. And we can respond much better to them in that context than we can in the virtual context. And I think that's going to be absolutely true in the telehealth world as well.
It parallels the importance of dinner as a family. When your kids come home from school, how was your day? Nothing happened. Who'd you play with? Nobody. What happened? Nothing. But when you sit at the dinner table and they're stirring their mashed potatoes and not eating them, you say, what's the matter? It's right in their faces. I would love to sit on one of your courses. I was looking at them, communication and persuasion, like the ancient Greeks who would walk around with their finger in the air, you know, getting the masses to follow what they wanted. Social psychology and communication, message effects. You are a master of so many important facets of communication. Let's talk a little bit about what we learned from the tobacco industry, the history of helping people to quit. What did you learn from that?
So we've been fortunate to have a lot of support to carry out our research into tobacco control broadly from the FDA and from the National Cancer Institute with colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's been a great opportunity to have had in my career. So some of the things that we've learned that are sort of larger scale kinds of communication strategies that are effective in tobacco control include the use of narratives as a part of the persuasive tools that we use. By narratives, of course, we mean nothing more than stories that people have about their lives. And we've learned that narratives tend to outperform, you know, simple factual information. If you can tell a story about what happens to you and what consequences that had for you and your loved ones in your life, whether it's in a 30-second PSA or whether it's in a longer story, whether it's textual with quotations from the individuals who are involved, or whether it's both visual and textual and audio, or if it's something as simple as having a visual that shows a person who has suffered because now through the effects on the respiratory system, they have a stoma, which is a hole in the throat through which they're breathing. You know, they talk about their own regrets in starting out on smoking and not having have been able to quit or find the tools necessary to quit. Those stories have a variety of kinds of impact over and above the simple factual versions. And the information can be the same in the story version and in the expository or fact version. And we know that people are attend to stories. We like stories. Everybody wants to hear a good story,
yes,
even if it's a sad story. And people find it easier to process the information in a story, even sometimes if it's statistical information, and they can recall it better. And sometimes even are more persuaded. They're more accepting of the claims in a story context than they are in a more expository kind of context. And we've used that in a lot of our research in other domains than tobacco control. But we certainly use it in tobacco control, I think, pretty successfully. That's one that I think has come forward. And we have a lot of good evidence to support this notion, as do other people. This is not like we're the only people who have focused in on the importance of narratives.
No, but you're so right. I opened up a story on the internet the other day, and there's a beautiful young woman in a popular TV show with a big scar on her back and said, "Tanny Booth's no, melanoma, massive." And you walk away with, maybe I know when I give lectures, which is pretty often, I never say, "Well, we're going to see 143.2 new cases of colon cancer this year." No. Look at your gym class. 1 in 8 people will get breast cancer. 1 in 3 people will get polyps. And then they say, "Ooh, that's pretty close to home." And I love the other thing you talk about, Joe, is the narrative, the whole idea of the story. Pre-bunking, that's another term that you use, pre-bunking instead of debunking. Yeah.
So, one of the other big lines of work that we've been engaged in and are still working on, actually, in the area of HPV, which is not in the tobacco domain, but in the tobacco domain, we did some studies on pre-bunking. This is the idea that before a person is, or when they're at the early stages of being exposed to misleading information, that you can keep them from being persuaded by that misleading information by warning them in advance that they're about to be exposed to misleading information, and giving them the kinds of counter arguments or contrary thoughts that would help to debunk the information they're about to receive. For example, we know that a particular brand of cigarettes called Natural American Spirit cigarettes, which are grown organically, and that's true, that's not a lie, but all of the advertising that they use implies that they might be therefore a healthier form of combustible tobacco. Because they're grown organically, and because they only are made from tobacco and water, or at least so they're claimed, and one of the sort of that leads to the assumption by folks that these are therefore a healthier form of combustible tobacco, and they're not. The only thing that you get from organic tobacco is organic lung cancer.
Right.
I mean,
with a bell on it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so what you need to understand is, you know, how do you take advertising like that and keep people from making that kind of false inference? And we've done some studies along those lines. We're doing some studies now in the HPV area that they use exactly the same kind of pre-bunking strategy that gets just directed at the young parents with young children who are about to be offered the opportunity to get the HPV vaccine, but they've been exposed to a lot of misinformation about the HPV vaccine online. And that false information, we're designing some studies now to debunk. And here we have some preliminary information that the debunking stuff works to keep people from being persuaded by some of the tweets that they read online that we have identified as the most concerning tweets. So in Tango, we take the anti-vaxxing kinds of tweets that are pretty strong, at least in terms of people's judgments, and then we try to debunk them. And we've done that in an experimental context. And now the next step is to move into the field itself to see if we can do some of that debunking for the HPV.
I guess you're up against also, for better or for worse, sometimes a celebrity endorsement just is bigger than a personal story. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Joe Capella.
Your Radio Doctor with Dr. Marianne Ritchie is presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX, the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.
Welcome back to our final segment of Your Radio Doctor. We call this segment Your Weekly Prescription. Joe, we're really learning so many important details about messaging from you. And one of them, the tobacco industry. I was looking at one of your previous interviews, and we referenced a campaign that it showed a typical airplane flying over the beach with a message. And it was really, everybody stopped to read this. It said, "What is in cigarette smoke?" Followed by another plane that said, arsenic, carbon monoxide, scary words, formaldehyde, styrenes, all, and now we know even more particles. So, but then along came the idea of vaping. And vaping, the intent is, if we can get you to have pretend cigarettes that will wean you from the bad guys and then eventually go off smoking. But what we know is you're not just inhaling steam. It's a good step down, perhaps, but what have you learned in that whole process of helping people convert from cigarettes to vaping to hopefully nothing?
So there's a lot in those comments there, Marianne. So let me pick up that advertisement just for a second first, and then slip over into the vaping topic. That advertisement, which uses those fancy words, I think is less effective than a version of exactly that. A set of ideas that was put forward by the FDA in what is called their Real Cost campaign. And what they did in their Real Cost campaign was they showed young people being chased by monsters from a swampy domain, and they labeled those monsters with the chemicals that are in cigarettes. And of course, it was a cigarette that was doing the chasing, but it was in the form of a monster. And so this is one of those cases where an animated kind of narrative was created to make people understand that simply by smoking a cigarette, you're going to be exposed to monsters who are going to do damage to you. And the monsters were the constituents that were a part of that cigarette activity. And of course, vapes have some of those same kinds of constituents, The problem with the vaping has been that is the appeal that vapes have to young people, and that is to the audience of young boys and girls who have, for the most part, not taken up combustible tobaccos, but have moved over into the vapes in part because they are technically modern-ish in character. They don't have the tars that combustible tobaccos have. But they are addictive, and that's the problem. And so as people become addicted to the nicotine that is there in very strong amounts in vapes, the possibility of essentially creating new customers for the tobacco industry and some version of the tobacco industry in order to satisfy that kind of addiction is really where the problem is with vapes. Vapes have some positive possibilities for adult smokers who are trying hard to quit but can't. They can get their nicotine hit, but reduce their exposure to carcinogens through the tars that they are not getting because they're doing vaping. But they are maintaining their addiction in some ways, and so people falling on and off of the wagon becomes problematic in that regard. So vaping is a complicated area, certainly the goal is to keep young people from taking up vaping. There was a huge upsurge in that, and the FDA has clamped down to some extent on vaping activity by taking flavors out of the equation, which is a big, big move by the FDA in the vaping area.
Sure, because we know nicotine can affect brain development,
yes.
and one
a cartridge can contain as much nicotine as a whole pack of cigarettes. Joe, this is so valuable. I want to sit on one of all of your classes, but short of that, what is your take-home message for our listeners?
Well, one of the things I want to say that I think is really consequential, and that goes back to the JAMA article that we started with in the clinician-patient interaction. And I want people to understand that effective communication in a medical in the medical environment with the clinicians and patients, it has medical outcomes. It's not just nice to have a good, effective communication between clinician and patient. It matters to the physical health of the patient, and it matters to the effectiveness of the physician, the clinician in this environment. And so I think we can't simply treat effective communication as something that would be, oh, that would be nice after everything else takes place. Sometimes everything else won't take place unless the communication
exactly.
is effective, unless you know what to say and how that is going to be received and presenting it in a way. And what we tried to do in that piece was to provide clinicians some simple guidance. You know, they've got enough on their plate without having to go crazy with a weeks of an hour classes and stuff like that. So some simple guidance that I think can help them think through how they want to be as a physician and how they can be better at their communications. And so, and therefore be better clinicians and physicians themselves and deliver better service.
An organized mind is an organized message, and we don't want patients to misinterpret and not take the medication properly, think that they're clear and free and they don't have to return for a checkup every year or whatever the direction is. It's so important. Dr. Joe Capella, thank you so much for your time and wisdom. And we really appreciate all that you brought to us today.
It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor every Saturday afternoon at 5 here on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. Listen to this show or any of our shows in our extensive library on Audacy.com, AUDACY.com. A special thank you to our exclusive sponsor, Independence Blue Cross, and we appreciate our association with Helio.com, the medical media company and information platform that offers the latest in healthcare news and information. Visit Helio.com for several great articles about the importance of good communication between a doctor and a patient. We also invite you to follow us on social media. We're very happy to see growing numbers of followers. It makes us want to work even harder to bring you topics that help you better understand common and not so common medical conditions. Because the more you understand, the more committed you'll be to take care of yourself and make good decisions. Send a question to our medical mailbag and let us know if you'd like us to mention your first name and your town on the air. Write to info@yourradiodoctor.net. Also, let us know about a champion in your family, workplace, or community. Send your champion story to info@yourradiodoctor.net. Tune in next Saturday as we continue our discussion surrounding the weight loss drugs that include Ozempic, Wegovy, Rybelsus, Victoza, Saxenda, Mounjaro, and Zepbound. We welcome the return of Jefferson dietitian Emily Rubin to discuss the diet that should be followed when you take these medications. Very helpful information. And please continue to pray for peace in our world, our country, our families, and in each of our own hearts. This is your radio doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, wishing you a happy, healthy, and safe week with the ones you love. Always here to remind you that your health is your wealth.
Thanks for listening to Your Radio Doctor, Dr. Marianne Ritchie, presented exclusively by Independence Blue Cross. To contact Dr. Marianne and to listen to today's show as well as past shows, visit yourradiodoctor.com. This program is paid for by Your Radio Doctor, LLC. All opinions or statements expressed on this program are solely those of Your Radio Doctor and their guests and do not reflect the opinions of WPHT or Audacy. Today's program has been pre-recorded.
At Independence Blue Cross, we take care of the people who take care of you. Everyday heroes like firefighters, teachers, farmers, and healthcare workers. Doctors and hospitals across the region have IBX, and they know what it means to have reliable access to care. So whether you're saving lives or just trying to live a healthier life, count on IBX.
the region's number one health insurer for 85 years. Learn more at IBX.com.